All right, so welcome everybody to the second podcast of Meaningful Matriarchs. Today we have Shush Nick, and she is of the Kachari clan, the Sitka, the Sakai Raven clan of, from Cake, otherwise known as the Kikwan. She worked as a CNA primarily in the Sitka Pioneer Home and specialized in geriatrics in that role. She is currently serving as a youth advocate for Sitka for about the last 8 years. So, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you very much. Nice introduction. I am doing really well. Feeling pretty good about this. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great. So, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what led you to this point in your life right now?
Yeah, I was very, well, I always have to mention that I've been clean and sober for quite a while, and that's,
Congrats.
thank you. That is always a cornerstone to mention because people are usually not used to seeing successful people who were once on Skid Row. So I always like to mention that because not only am I indigenous, I'm an indigenous woman. So right there is two counts against me. And
Oh, I totally relate.
yeah, and I am happy to say that the more that the longer I'm in this, the better I feel. I can't ever remember feeling this whole, I believe, is what it would be. The
Awesome.
wholeness of being who I am, and my identity is solid. Nobody needs to question that, and I don't have an obligation to try to fill in the gap where people have a tendency to see things much differently than I do, but I'm more confident, and I don't plan on stopping anytime soon.
I hope not. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cake,
Okay.
and I actually left there a day after I graduated from high school.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty brave. I mean, I'm not one to talk though because I spent like the summer working for a construction company and I'm like, I'm out of here, and I flew all the way to Florida, so I can relate for the desire to just spread our wings. And then what'd you do after that?
I went to work for a youth group, coincidentally, and had a pretty good start there where we did some contracting for the Forest Service with outdoor trailblazing. And yeah.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I was forced into that job when I was like 15, and yeah, Karen, I just remember being told by my parents like, oh, by the way, you got to go to work with the Forest Service, and I was so ill prepared for that, and I just remember having to hike a lot and carry a lot, and that was the last summer I did that, so.
Yeah,
So what?
I held on to that job for at least 3 seasons. That was a good one, and
Oh, nice.
that was a good one to learn how to navigate the what the Forest Service actually does, and compared to how indigenous people care for the land and always have. So,
So was that where your desire as a youth to become a youth advocate? So take us along a little bit, just kind of your career and how you ended up being a youth advocate you are today.
Yeah, I'd have to say I've always had skin in the game for youth. If I wasn't involved, I tried to get away from it a couple of times and found that it wasn't until actual suicide that impacted my life quite a bit. When I worked with a couple of crews and had to look at the other side of that coin in a very different way and really truly evaluate what it meant to be a role model and to actually stand for something. And I just remember thinking that I needed to get motivated about the kinds of youth we have, what their issues are, and how I can help that along. And
So,
then I went to work for a program called Access in the mental health field, and worked as a private contractor and worked with youth who were on probation. So it's always been the hands-on jobs that really got my attention and made me see things for what they are and not what people said they are. And start
Yeah,
and
so it's so if so you've kind of always had like a role or some sort of presence in advocacy of sorts. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So here you are, and you have a really critical role, I think. And I love that you mentioned the difference between hands-on and then just saying, because sometimes we see a lot today, at least, a lot of I guess marketing spins is the best way I can put it, about statements and quotes and cliche comments, but it's finding the outcomes and the actions that are actually going to change the well-being and status of not just our people, but for you particularly, our youth. How do you feel? How different or the same do you feel that the issues surrounding our youth are as compared to, say, when you were younger, or are they similar?
I'd have to say today is a lot more challenging because we're in a pandemic and we're looking for our ability as human beings, our ability as human beings to look for solutions have rapidly changed from the time that I was a teenager. When I was a teenager, a lot of things were tangible. We could just go out and do whatever we wanted to do, pretty much. But we also had a serious obligation to our families. And we were raised in the outdoors. And they took us out. We had to work on fish in the early morning hours. We had to learn how to clean them and gut them, can them. And we also harvested quite a bit of berries. I remember doing a lot of canning with my grandmother specifically, who was Mona Jackson from Cake, and my grandfather is Tommy Jackson. But yeah, we would, I remember we would go out for days on end just to harvest on a boat. We would go out and
I love that you bring that up, because it just the issue of sovereignty for our people is almost become just a, how do you say, a phrase, and not so much something that we tangibly experience. So how do you feel like it's apparent that it's definitely changed to the reality we have today? But how does sovereignty actually relate? How do you feel about sovereignty as an Indigenous woman and an Indigenous woman in Alaska?
sovereignty allows me freedom. Sovereignty makes me feel that As an Indigenous woman, that I have a responsibility to pave the way for what the values need to look like by the time our kids are ready to, not just a parent, but to be those aunties and uncles that we had. And we had some of the toughest. We had the ones who were willing to tell us when we were wrong, why it was wrong in their eyes, and what we needed to do to make things right, especially with people. We were always moving in that direction, and that gave me this idea in my young life, much younger life, before I even left my hometown, that I needed to represent myself, just me. I didn't need to represent everything and everybody else. And I had some awesome aunties who always told me, you need to get up out of that chair and go after life. Go after the things that you want. Don't stand back and expect people to hand it to you, because it's not going to happen. You need to go and get it. If it isn't there, you need to make it happen.
I love that. I love that so much because a lot of us growing up didn't have those aunties and those nons really keeping us, in that path and pushing us to become more than we thought we were. And I feel like that a lot of our youngers nowadays too also struggle with that because of many of the social challenges and ills that we deal with as Indigenous people. And one of the issues that I want to talk about today, as it pertains to you as a professional Indigenous woman, is issues of credibility and validity for women. I know from personal experience, it's a very real thing, but it's something we don't really talk about. We kind of adopted this suffer in silence value. And if you don't know, or people listening all across the country may not know, but Alaska is the most dangerous state for women. And I think in 2016 we had about 100, there were 116 reported MMIW issues to the DOJ for the nation. Alaska was rated number one for the most dangerous for women and Indigenous women. And so I feel like there's a lot of contributing factors to being an Indigenous woman and issues like our MMIW. So why don't can you tell us of an experience that you had that really challenged you as a Indigenous woman that you felt contributed to you not being as vocal as maybe you are today and kind of pushed you into the direction you are as an advocate today?
Sure. There are issues like rape and sexual assault that contribute to the code of silence. And when people take on the code of silence, it becomes a matter of injustice. And I think people know more victims than they do perpetrators. And there are more perpetrators than the average, I believe, in the villages. And the way that the court has treated Native women in general, I think, now I have some pretty harsh views about the US Constitution, because that was authored by the patriarchy. The patriarchy does not see or mention anything about women or indigenous people because it was written during a time of genocide. And genocide was the main crux of the interference of the Constitution directly. Like we were hindered, we were stopped. And so
So what was, I'm sorry. So
as a
So what was a moment just for you though, personally?
well, personally, I won't deny that there was a story written by ProPublica. And I wrote that, that was a project that we worked on that has a lot more meaning now than ever. And I get ostracized by a certain demographic of people who have a much harder time accepting that there are other people on the parameter of success. And
Yeah, I love that you're trying to be delicate and kind, but okay, for my audience, what she's trying to say, and what I've always really you'll notice with this show is that it's we have multiple layers as Indigenous women dealing with the issues and speaking up, and we already know that non-Native, non-Indigenous, non-people of color society, white society has put these pressures and obstacles to us. But what we don't like talking about, what has become historically uncomfortable, what we've been told not to talk about, is in our own community, in our own Indigenous circles, we also experience and suffer abuse and chastising and basically this unhealthy social norm of don't you dare speak up against our own people, even if our own people are the perpetrators, the ones abusing you. So we suffer in silence in multiple levels. So the whole purpose behind my show is to give that voice and start breaking down that old status quo of silence. You know, a lot of our elders and our few old ancestors and generations like my mom, my grandmas, those generations suffered historical trauma of removal and things like that. So that carried a lot of baggage and they adopted different ways of living that weren't necessarily our ancestral ways. And so as Indigenous women, and I've heard it myself, is like, oh, well, they're family, or that's your cousin, that's your uncle. And I'm here to say no more. Like, no more. We have to speak up about injustice, even when it's injustice suffered at the hands of our own people, our own men, our own women, if they're the perpetrators. Because individually, you have value, you have worth, and we aren't meant to suffer in silence for the perceived collective good, which is actually at the detriment of our own people, ourselves. This is why we have tremendous, tremendous suicide rates all across the country is, I believe, silence is a contributing factor because we're not being heard. So I totally, totally love that you brought that up. We will be providing a link to that article on our website, thetangiblevisions.com. But yeah, and so a couple other things you may not know. But if there's a take home message from you individually, your impact statement that you want people to really, the listeners to really meditate on, what would that be?
to really take into consideration the damage that's been done, because trauma means that something has already happened. And when I see a little 8-year-old boy experiencing post-traumatic stress or an episode of it, and people around him don't know how to help him, that gets tossed aside. And we need to start coming to terms with the wording of domestic violence, and have those words changed from domestic violence into assault. Because domestic violence only pertains to events within the home. It's exactly what it says it is. It's domestic violence, and that's how it gets treated. So if the perpetrator or the person committing the act of violence is not related to the other person, then that's how the court recognizes that issue, which is really crazy because really we're recycling the system. And I believe that that's what we need to do. We need to bring it home that domestic violence and sexual assault are not friendly neighbors, but they are related to each other. Domestic violence and sexual assault and rape. There's too many stereotypes and not enough people saying we actually need to get this work done. Let's start with where our children are at with mental health issues. And that, I mean, really, I've done some things that I'm really proud of. I've done some work that are trademarks to me, and they're very, very personal. And I would not just convey that to the world. But, people need to learn about who we are, not what they think we are, but who we are as Indigenous women. There are some very, very powerful Indigenous women out there. My mom was one of them. And I just see what I do as an imprint of who she was. So, in that way, the matriarchal system works. And we can make it even more powerful when we start coming together and realizing that there really is enough room by the fire for all of us to share in our common goals. But it's kind of hard to say the things that I want to say in 20 minutes, and it's
No, I totally, I know it's I hope that, I'll have definitely other issues and we can deep dive into more of this content. And I just wanted to start getting people to think about what this all means. And the reason I chose credibility and validity, because like, and I mentioned, we talked about this yesterday in your campaign in 2018. We talked, I, in your interview, you said you're in one, I, your sentence, I don't necessarily have a college education. And I always feel like as an Indigenous woman for myself, I always have to like validate, like do an intro validation to who I am instead of just saying what you have to say. And is that kind of something you've learned over the years, that you feel like you do have to validate your experience qualifications to whatever you're advocating for? Like, what were your thoughts to that?
When I was first terminated, like my very first job termination, right, in real life, was devastating to me. And I wasn't expecting it, but I found that in a room full of white people, that Native is pretty close to non-existent. In their minds, on paper, in demographics, the only place it makes sense is in the when we do the census surveys. We have to deliberately mark down that we are an actual race. So after I was fired, I realized that the things that I had been saying prior to that termination was, my culture is my education, and people need to learn about my culture because I can't relate to this stuff, meaning the English context of being native. And I was always, at being asked to give like a talk on being native, and I'm like, oh my God.
I am familiar with that question, and I love your explanation, and I feel like not just in white society, but in nowadays in our own Native society, at least I've experienced this, even my education, because we all grew up hearing our grandmas, our nones, our elders saying, "Go get educated, come help your people." Well, I have never in my life thought having an education then nowadays was considered bad. I mean, here in on Prince of Wales, I mean, it's not a good thing. I've been kind of insulted a couple times about my education, so it's such a weird thing. But the take home from that is, even in our Indigenous circles, which is predominantly, it's dominated by men. Let's be real. A lot of it is dominated by men who may or may not be qualified to speak on our behalf, because everything about our Indigenous circles has basically morphed into something else. It is not how it historically was, but I find myself constantly having to introduce myself to validate what I'm gonna say. So I'm like, "Oh, I'm Stacy. I have, 2 degrees. I have 20 years of experience," and I have to do all this pre-introduction before I say what I'm gonna say. And it's really almost demeaning, if that makes sense, because my male counterparts never have to do that. Rarely do they. They get to just go dive right in. So as Indigenous women, I hope we can shift that social norm we experience today into something new. And speaking with people like you, I feel like is really going to start opening those doors for
Yeah,
us.
because if you look at the protocol of how our people used to live, talking about the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people, they lived according to protocol and clanship, and clanship was protocol. So we ultimately were functioning with an actual democracy of people.
Yeah, by our roles and our, what we provided to the community, not
Yeah,
who we
which
were.
is
And there wasn't a concept of, like hierarchy of things. It was everybody was critical to the community, and that's just the way it
yeah, because
was.
even in, colonization, I like one comparison that has always gotten me the wrong way is like it within the educational institutions is that they have a department called special ed, right? What did we have? We were very inclusive. We included everybody, even those who were not at levels that other high-functioning people were at. And we never called them disabled. We never, we never handicapped a stereotype to fit whatever that perception needed to be. And that's what I've always loved about our culture is that we were very non-judgmental because of our democracy. We never had all these pronouns and political correctness and, all of which systematically is an entirely different subject, but yet all the same.
Tribal politics. That's a whole nother series that I definitely will be covering. And I totally understand what you're saying. And I want my listeners to understand too that you can look back and realize, if I love history, I love reading everything I can about it. And the one thing that I learned is that our ancestors, even our great grandparents, lived in a totally different social structure that was minimally influenced by Western European white culture. And so the protocols and things you see today at doings is not the same. It is just an adaptation through time. And so you have to have that view a little different, is that this is just what was adapted over time. This is not true to, and close to how our ancestors actually did things. And I think people don't realize that or understand that is how far our cultures have morphed into something else that we see
Yeah,
today.
And that also includes the platform of crimes. We never had
Yes.
crimes. We had people who were banned. They were banned if they committed the
Yes.
crimes. And so
Yes, I remember those stories. My grandpa would talk to, oh yeah, well, so and so stole something and they were kicked out of the village. I'm like, what? And they would talk about people who used to live here, or people who literally were kicked out of the tribe and were forced to go all live elsewhere. And it's such a foreign concept. I mean, and this issue of accountability is dear to my heart too, because now look at it, we have very minimal accountability within our indigenous circles. And at least from my perception, actual tangible accountabilities, because you still have, abused victims having to attend functions with people who abuse them. You have, like in Kluwak, you have mayors who were charged with solicitation still able to sit in their seat, because then you deal with the, they were all, it was a familial family relationships get in the way of us really being able to hold each other accountable. And it is definitely not like it used to be, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's just a lot of systematic and social injustice, a lot of work that needs to be done. And my primary concern is always for the young people because they have a lot to say, but like us, they're not being given the spaces. It's just more like all this, we don't need to hear any of that. Or if someone is really suffering, like we had that Jason Abbott case a few years ago when we first moved here. And the thing about that incident is that he was setting off red flags left and right way before the actual incident even occurred. And he also had a domestic violence charge against him from his first relationship. And all of this is like out there. You can find this information on Google. But he was setting off alarms, and he was also telling people that he was not well. And I'm saying, you know what? We really need to pay attention to these people. They know what, like I've always said that a sick person knows they're sick. They know they are. It's nothing anybody needs to diagnose. People who are not well will say they're not well. But how many people actually listen to that? So there's like this wide spectrum of people who will say, this is not okay. I'm not okay. Someone please help me. And working in the mental health field, I'd have to say that I have a very strong intuition, and I believe that all Indigenous women have this built-in radar. And it's very powerful because we're such a minority who gets overlooked, overstepped, and undercounted. So, but yet, everyone, society in general is forced to see us through this patriarchal lens, which also includes victimology. And to me, that is what we need to change. We need to change the wording of how we talk to people and how people perceive us as who we are. I don't know how many times I've said, I am a Tlingit and Haida woman. I'm not just Indigenous. We have a context for who we are. The world doesn't need to tell me who I am. I know who I am. And the education that our kids have, all that is fine and dandy, but you know what? I've always found time and again that the very skills that I was taught by my family still is my greatest education to this day. It is still my primary source of strength. And when I feel beat up by the world, I can go and hibernate in my artwork and just have the artwork heal those areas that the world tries to obscure or redefine or judge.
I love that. I love that you said that, and we'll kind of segue out of that because for me, I grew up in a different generation, right? I was like, go get educated. So I left, and my parents never taught me anything about my culture, never spoke to me in my language, nothing. And a lot of my generation, that was the same experience. We were intentionally assimilated because they genuinely believed that we would have a better chance in the white world. And now there was for a long time this huge emptiness and gap that was my cultural identity, and I knew that was missing. And so now I'm like, I've absorbed and is self-teaching myself a lot about my people and through my art. That's why I believe art can heal. Art can heal. Like, I take a lot of these syrup bottles and I make glassware. And but yeah, I totally feel you on that. And so I'm super excited to see what you have coming. I know you're working on a couple projects, and we will promote that for you as much as we can once you get that up and running. But do you have an existing website or organization that you want to promote here on our show?
I would say I would actually encourage people to look more and more into what's happening in the mental health field, because I feel that we as a society of Native people are actually headed in the right direction. We just need to help each other along through this pandemic to figure out how to help our youth to get through this time. I feel that our youth are manifesting things that could be of greater value down the road, but we need to tap into that as a resource. We need to hear their voices and lift them up. We need to help them when they need it, and we need to be there when they need us to be there. Not when we think it's convenient, but when they need us to actually be there. I can't tell you how many times my intuition has served me accurately with that, time and time and time again. And also helping our young women to be validated and feel like they exist, not as shadows, but as young women who have a responsibility to our culture. Otherwise,
Well, to
yeah.
themselves as well, to themselves. And that is one of the premise behind this show, is to help give them a voice as well. And so I will be providing links to this show on my website, thetangiblevisions.com. It'll be on Spotify under a Meaningful Matriarch. And I'm sure this will not be the last time we are speaking. I am super excited that you are willing to dive into this, and I know it feels like an onion and all these different layers start exposing themselves. So if you know of anybody that has a story to share, please refer them my way. And I think the more of us start openly speaking about our experience of Indigenous women, I think we'll start to see a positive change in a new direction for not just our youth, but ourselves. So thank you for calling in, and I hope to
Thank
speak
you,
to you again.
Stacy.